Welcome to the American Reformer Podcast, hosted by Josh Abatoy and Timon Klein. Our mission is to promote a vigorous Christian approach to the cultural challenges of our day, rooted in the rich tradition of Protestant social and political thought.
Hello and welcome back to the American Reformer Podcast. You've got me, Josh Abatoy, Executive Director, and Timon Klein, the Editor-in-Chief. And today we've got a very special guest, Micah Meadowcroft. Micah's the contributing editor at the American Conservative. He's an alum of the Trump administration. He's a fellow research director at the Center for Renewing America and has done and written many other interesting things. Micah, welcome.
Thank you, Josh. Good to be here. Good to be here, Timon. Good to see you guys.
Well, before we just jump in, we always like people to give a little bit of a bio, you know, a 2-minute, how did you get to the work that you're in now? Can you give us a quick rundown on that?
Yes, I'll do my best. So I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, where I fell in love with the natural beauty of the continental United States. And then I went to undergrad at Hillsdale College, studied history and did a little bit of journalism there. Started my career in political media. That's how I ended up in Washington, D.C. And then felt the need to study for its own sake. So I went to the University of Chicago, did a master's degree in political theory, wrote on political theology and technology. Came back to D.C. to briefly join the Trump administration as kind of part of Johnny McEntee's Hail Mary passes towards the end of the administration. Was at the Environmental Protection Agency as White House liaison there, really enjoyed my time there, learned a lot, and then joined the American Conservative. I was web editor at the American Conservative for a couple of years, and then Russ Vogt, Trump's OMB director, came knocking. He had started the Center for Renewing America. They needed a research director, and I was happy to hop on board, and it's an exciting time to be thinking about what a future conservative administration could look like and how to fix the problems, build things instead of just yelling stop. So glad to be here.
Awesome. Thank you. And I think that as we started thinking about the cause of the podcast, really we wanted to have you on broadly speaking to talk about your work on the conservationism front. And in particular, you've been an advocate of an idea that I love. It's very evocative. It's great for memes as well, but the idea of rewilding. Why don't you introduce people to that concept in a couple of minutes? What is it and why should we all want it?
So rewilding is the advocacy for returning spaces to their natural ecosystems. In particular, the meme-worthy version is to say bison nationalism. The North America used to have coast-to-coast millions of bison, as most Americans know. Eventually, we pushed them out and hunted them to death. There are now very, very few, but there are efforts to bring them back. They're our national mammal. They're a keystone species in most of Central American, and I'm talking about North America, the prairie ecosystem, rightly, you know, when left to its own devices, the bison play a critical role. And so I think there's a lot of land use and agricultural policy choices that, for me at least, the idea of bringing back the bison acts as a good shorthand for how we make those choices and why we would want to. Now, to the broader philosophical question of what is rewilding and why does it matter, rewilding assumes that, or at least as I understand it and as I try to write about it, that we live in an environment, and by environment, I mean the built environment that is dominated by human ingenuity, human creativity, but that mediates between ourselves and the natural order that we're a part of. Now, of course, there's something good there, right? Creation, the Bible begins in a garden and ends in a city. So there's a place for man in taking dominion to build and to create this mediation. At the same time, when all of our lived environment is already built up such that we are never encountering anything that we could say is in kind of a natural state, but is always in some sort of humanly ordered or disrupted state. We are removed from a certain access to general revelation. So as a Christian, why I think rewilding is important is that we are cutting ourselves off of general revelation when we live in these hypermediated environments. The internet, of course, compounds this issue, where not only do we, you know, move from our pod to our commute to our office and our cubicle, but now we also live most of our lives outside of our bodies, casting our consciousness into the ether of the internet. And that's not to say that that's not an enormously helpful tool in a lot of ways, and like enabling some very important developments. At the same time, it makes the need to be conscious of creation and our place in it and our bodies all the more important. And so that's why I advocate for rewilding.
Yeah, that's huge. One thing I want to sort of double click on in what you just said is that exposure to, you know, call it general revelation or even call it natural law, like this has this mitigating effect on, you know, false human constructions. I think, like in and maybe, you know, maybe in a way it's actually heightened right now relative to times in the past where human society is so generally obsessed with this idea of the autonomous, expressive individual who's free from all unchosen bonds, right? Like we, you know, you can change your gender if you don't like it. You can, you know, the human person is just totally Plato. And we conceive of, you know, deep truths as social constructs. But on the other hand, you know, at a time when human society is very much committed to those ideas, there's something very kind of radical and basic and real about being in the natural world and just observing the natural way of things. You learn a lot about life and it makes you think, you know, kind of based forbidden thoughts about human nature too, when you can see how nature itself is, you know, runs out there.
Right. And I think there are two parts to that. On the one hand, American history, it's just a fact that our institutions, our way of life, and our government were set up with a common sense understanding of natural law as their public theology, as the basis for our agreed upon federal public theology, and as a Protestant characterization of that. And so when we are cut off from a common sense understanding of natural order and limits, and especially when we are when we do think about nature, when we think of it only in terms of nature red in tooth and claw, a kind of very Darwinian antagonistic account of the natural order, and then oppose that to man's conquest of nature. And as you say, this autonomy, one of the things that ends up getting forgotten there, of course, is that, as C.S. Lewis says in The Abolition of Man, man's growing power over nature is in fact some men's growing power over other men, with nature as the tool or as the instrument. That is, as we have grown our capacity to instrumentalize nature to, you know, chop kids' genitalia off, etc., the subjects of that physical manipulation are human beings. And the supposed autonomy is actually to further subject you to these orders of power and mechanization, and to reduce the human person to just more mechanical, you know, more matter for manipulation. So that's the critical kind of why this is vital at the moment. And then of course we can talk to sort of double back on my comment. Like we can talk about the American history, the 19th century, the Civil War kind of marks a rupture where that old account of natural law is starting to have its foundations shaken in this conflict over what does it mean to be a human being? What do we owe other human beings? What is the imago Dei in the slavery question? But then also the triumph of the industrial North means that we end up doubling down. Like our power becomes as a country, as a transcontinental power, is tied up with this subjection of the natural order to human ingenuity. At the same time, you have the frontier maintaining some degree of the old tradition, right? And access to the natural world as the pioneer spirit, which I think the West Coast still, you know, part of what's distinctive, I think, about West Coast conservatism, besides just growing up around a bunch of libs, is that we have this awareness culturally still, memory of that pioneer conquest and really carving out civilization, which, you know, we best see in kind of like John Ford westerns and things like that, that story, that mythologization of the frontier. But it closes, right? By the early 20th century, it's closing. And I don't think it's a total coincidence that logical positivism and legal positivism mm-hmm. are becoming the dominant intellectual milieu in elite American society. So the Northeast, the heavily industrialized Northeast, in the 19th century as well. And then that becomes the framework for the early 20th century. And of course, we see the consequences of this reductionist view of man in the world wars. And there's a reason, you know, postmodernity emerges out of this failure of modernity, that as we reduced the natural world and human beings to so much material, that then we saw the consequences in total war, in mechanized warfare, and the kind of destruction of public theology, of chivalry, of any sort of sense for Christendom, and we're living in the aftermath. And so, to me, rewilding and the deliberate return to taking on the dominion mandate and to say, okay, how do we get a better sense for who we are as sons and daughters of Adam? What's the Chronicles of Narnia, how's it put it? Sons of Adam and daughters of Eve. That, like, what does that look like? Well, that's going to take more work now. Now that we have all these extra layers of mediation built up. And so, yeah, we should articulate it, and it should have kind of a political component to it, because it does. It's making a claim about human nature, there being a human nature, and about it also being something under question, that we have achieved a degree of, you know, a capacity for self-destruction, self-distortion, dementation, maybe. There's something diabolical about it. And so we have to be on guard. Mm. And rewilding is a kind of, you know, neutral, safe, fun, easy, as you say, meme-worthy way of advancing it. I think, you know, because we're on the American Reformer podcast, I'll say there's a way in which I think of rewilding as the natural revelation side of a similar project to what, you know, some people are calling Christian nationalism. You don't necessarily have to call it that. You can just call it public Christianity and the restoration of that. That in the same way that we look back at the founding, or we look back at the early 19th century and say, well, we were obviously a Christian culture, and there were these things that were implicit, understood, taken for granted. But now we've lost them to such a degree that you have to articulate them, re-articulate them very explicitly to reinsert them into society. And we saw that in the 50s and 60s, you know, the Eisenhower administration's desire to re-articulate America's Christian character in opposition to godless communism. Like, we know how this play goes, but we're having, you know, every time to say the old thing again in a new context is to have to say it in a slightly different way. And so, you know, on the one hand, in the natural revelation sense, we have rewilding. And then in the particular revelation sense, we have a kind of, in the negative world, as Ayn Rand puts it, the need to now rearticulate in an antagonistic context, special revelation too, in our political sphere.
There's so much there that you just said that I want to follow up on, but I think what I'm hearing partly is, you know, you touched on the triumph of the industrial North in the Civil War. And then, of course, the thing that goes along with that is the triumph of, I guess, a proto progressivism that's really emanating from the North and from the new research universities that are getting planted in the North, which are bringing sort of this, in its earliest forms, it's sort of Hegelian inspired progressivism, right? Which then works its way out and gains ascendancy by the 1920s. But at its core, there's this kind of distrust of all things natural and this desire to manage them, which is different than taking dominion. But it's sort of a desire to order them all to more efficient, productive ends. And of course, that extends to humans as well. So, I mean, I'm hearing, tell me if this is right, but I'm hearing what you're saying partly that rewilding is more than just a call to have wild animals running all over our nation again. Partly it's a call to for humans to be rewilded.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. There's a way in which we have bought the lie of the capacity to fully rationally order, not just society, but the natural world. And I guess it goes in the other way, like, because we could so easily rationalize parts of the natural world, we have then, you know, so progressivism takes sort of the insight of like Comtean positivism that looks around and says, wow, we've done such a good job in ordering material matter and natural order, then why not do this to society as well? Like, why? So it gave us the impression that we could, and now we've seen 150 years of what trying to do so looks like, and we're kind of seeing some of the really grotesque consequences of it. I mean, we have a century of grotesque consequences, but in particular, as it extends to treating, I think Mary Harrington describes it as the meat Legos or something to that effect, that as we treat the human body now as this interchangeable bits and parts. We're going to see how far the train can go, and it's really scary.
Yeah. And like humans left to their own devices tend to form like communities that progressivism very much wants to manage and suppress, right? I mean, progressive, especially in the like sort of communism and the more extreme forms, you can see this most clearly, right? But really a lot of different progressives following Hegel, they don't like the family and other kind of natural ways that humans tend to organize themselves, because they think it's inefficient, and they also think it's a threat to the rational state that wants to impose a rational order on society. It seems to me like, you know, if you're letting humans rewild to some extent, you're going to see more, you know, networks of like extended families looking after each other. And, you know, maybe, of course, going along with that, a little nepotism, which we consider a dirty word now, but used to be sort of just natural basic human instinct, right? And I think, you know, most crucially, like humans caring about their own, you know, wanting to honor their ancestors and then give something to their descendants, right? So this was sort of the defining thing, even if you read the Old Testament. What's the great promise to Abraham that makes him so excited? It's that I'm going to make a great nation out of you. Like your descendants will have prosperity and all of this. Those are very natural human motivators that have, you know, carried society along through many different, you know, eras, and it looks different in different places. But in many ways, progressivism wants to manage that, wants to take the human person out of those kind of naturally arising bonds and duties and obligations and you know, atomize them to where they're, you know, really just looking at the world from the point of a passive consumer rather than an active person who wants to create a legacy.
Mm-hmm. For a kind of negative illustration that might be familiar to many of the listeners, Aldous Huxley's Brave New World provides a kind of crude picture taken to, you know, to the absurd ends of, it's in some sense what I'm talking about, that in Brave New World, there are literal reservations for the non-genetically modified, non-factory grown human beings, right? So in Brave New World, the dystopia, I mean, I guess if you're a leftist of a certain stripe, it's a utopia, but the dystopia is one in which everyone has their predetermined place in the social hive, in the mechanical structure of the state, and at the very level of their, you know, fetal development is being shaped for and fitted to the technology of the state. And there are the only people who weren't part of that process literally live on reservations. So sort of what I'm saying when we talk about the need to rewild beyond just the rewilding of America's natural beauty, or the conservation of America's natural beauty, is that in a sufficiently grown up hedge of mediation and control, systems of control and management, this attempt to rationalize in left progressivism. And I say left progressivism because it's a rationalism dedicated to the kind of minimization of distinction, as you say, the individuation, but it's not individuation in the sense of the fulfillment of an individual's full capacities. It's rather just the reduction of you to one more cog in the machine, one more atom in the molecule that is the state. So this process in such a thick hedge of, well, I shouldn't use hedge because that's an organic, you know, picture, but like this is, there's a need to conserve human nature because human nature is now under question, is itself one of the things being experimented upon. So there is a way in which we have to talk about this as a kind of conservation act for human beings as they were meant to be. Now, it gets us into some thorny theological questions, and different people might have different answers as regards to, you know, what is the essential feature of human nature? What is accidental? What is core? What is the imago Dei actually reflected in? And then what is actually subject to manipulation? Like, how far could we go, right? Unchecked, where would transhumanism sort of stop? When does nature win again? I tend to, perhaps just because I'm a conservative, well, conservative, hard term to use because politically, you know, there's not a lot left to conserve, but there is human nature to conserve. And, but at the same time, I'm confident enough in the natural order to say that nature will probably win out, but it is in some sense just open enough that that I think it merits taking action. I'm not going to be passive in the face of these attacks on the human person. To take a step back and recontextualize this historically, I do think there's a way in which we could say, I mean, the godfather of American environmental policy, conservationism, is really Theodore Roosevelt, right? And in giving us the national park system, et cetera. I think Roosevelt, to put it really crudely, we have a kind of a story of two Roosevelts. Theodore Roosevelt gives us our last glimpse of what a truly kind of right-wing progressivism might look like, that says, what if we try to rationally order industrial society in a way that reflects natural order, in a way that preserves created spaces, natural spaces for human flourishing, that recognizes the ways in which industrial society and technology has disrupted these traditional modes of life, and that in some sense there's no going back, that technology does induce a kind of necessary progress or directionality to history and requires new political tools to address it, perhaps, that like certain traditional modes are not going to return en masse. We might be able to conserve them in certain places, but that as a national project, we're going to have to address things anew, kind of grasping the bull of modernity by the horns. And then instead, you have with Wilson and the First World War, the setup and triumph of left progressivism that then says, no, actually, we're going to treat all individuals as component parts of the state, that the collective state entity is itself the end rather than the tool, and we'll rationalize. And that rationalization that the state can then impose through bureaucratic means and the mechanization of public life will provide some sort of fulfillment of our idea of the human, of humanity now in the abstract, right? Mankind, capital M, humanity, capital H, not particular human persons, not human nature itself, not the imago Dei, but rather, you know, man as God, basically the divinization that was implicit in whether you're talking about left Hegelianism or positivism, et cetera. And so that's the world we do live in, is this triumph of left progressivism. And we see this in the administrative state and conversations about why that's a problem, what that does. I mean, the administrative state is itself the articulation of, oh, we can rationalize every mode of life by subjecting it to expert control. But these experts themselves are parts of a larger mechanical structure. They're not responsible individuals. They're cogs in a larger machine. And through the collective cooperation of this government as technology, some sort of rational order is imposed upon what is essentially a kind of pre-Christian demiurgic chaos vision of the natural order. That's just something that needs to have rationality imposed upon it, rather than to say God already did that. God spoke, created order into being. You know, the earth was formless and void, but then God spoke.
Yeah, Timon, jump in here if you want to interrupt. Otherwise, I'm just going to be interrogating Micah for the entire show.
No, I feel compelled to interrupt you. Yeah, for the sake of the audience and Micah, this is my duty. So Micah, I mean, several things. I mean, you and Josh talking was great. I mean, lots of things are coming to mind. One initial question, since you brought up, Father Ted, Teddy Roosevelt, not the other Uncle Ted, but the question I would have with those particular policies of, you know, at the time they may have been, it was the best thing to do at the time, right? Create the national park system, try to preserve these places from being further corrupted, you might say. But what it seems to do to me at this time is, you know, it creates something to visit, almost like Disney World. It's separate from us. It may be preserved, and that's great, and it's protected, but it requires a sort of bureaucracy to continue to protect, but it's not integrated into human life for most people. There's areas of the country where it may be more integrated, but for most people, it's not. So, I mean, how does your perspective account for the attempt at reintegrating that same impulse or same aspiration into regular life, so that all people are able to, you know, in our country, it's a vast country. I would say a fault of most American policy has been to not recognize how vast and diverse it is in ways of life and in landscape. But it's a vast country. It's very rich in natural resources and in natural beauty. But most people are just, you know, confined to sort of cities and that sort of life, and it's not integrated. And so then they have to come up with like hokey things to try to reintegrate that feel, but it's not as real as it should be.
Right. I mean, part of that is the realities of an increasingly urbanized society. And that was true. I mean, that's kind of the characteristic social disruption of the early Industrial Revolution. And we're seeing another round of urbanization in the kind of post-industrial economy too, that certain metropolitan mega, you know, super centers, super cities become the locus of so much of economic life. And so, as you say, a lot of people are removed from access to the national parks that we do have and from the ways in which there is still a conservation of wild spaces. I don't know that there's an easy fix, right? Central Park is a park, it's a garden, it's not wilderness. At the same time, that's better than nothing, you know? So there's certainly ways in which I'm extremely grateful for the effectiveness of growing up outside of Portland, Oregon. You know, Portland has both park blocks, which is just literally city blocks converted to park space throughout the city. But then also, because it's built into a hill along the river, up into the hills is left largely wild, you know, semi-cultivated, but largely wild space, park space. There's like basic movements there. And then there's hokey stuff, as you kind of referred to, like urban gardening, et cetera, that people can do to restore access, some sense of natural order, natural rhythms of life, seasonality. But this reminds me, these kinds of conversations and these hard questions reminds me of my time at the EPA. One of the ongoing, I'm sure you'll hear more of it, we'll all hear more about this in general as environmental politics heats up. Environmental justice is a program now, you know, it's statutorily baked into America's environmental policies. Right. And since I think HW started a shift under HW, Bill Clinton did a lot of it, and then W and Obama continued it. It's sort of, you just can't get rid of it as such. So one of the things that we discussed in my brief time at EPA was, well, okay, if we can't just like ignore this, and these are going to be grants going to so-called environmental justice, which normally ends up becoming ways in which you can antagonize racial grievances, but with claims about climate on top of it. Well, how do we keep it away from the hucksters and actually use it for what it's supposed to be, which is how do we give access to the inheritance that is America's created beauty, natural beauty, to people who live in highly, highly urban artificial environments? And so in thinking about that, I mean, I don't see why we shouldn't have more programs that just get people out of the cities. And if you're going to be in the public school, then, mm-hmm. you know, perhaps I think it would be a great benefit rather than, you know, you being in prison all day. Perhaps you should be taking long field trips. And, you know, that's going to disrupt. Yeah, there's lots of difficulties and friction to a program like that. But the goal should be to just directly address it and say like, oh, you grew up in the inner city. Let's get you out there and seeing, you know, a calf be born or just taking hikes for Pete's sake. We got so much parkland just outside of cities that people could encounter, could go to if they were given the chance. And so, I mean, I think some of these questions, it's just a practical case of like, what's the best we can do?
So I think we've started already shifting in this direction, but I want to sort of move the conversation towards some practical questions here. So, you know, like, if you're the next Republican president's environmental czar, you know, and you can just have your way with all of our conservation policy, what would you do? I mean, what would you change relative to what we do now? And then what are some new ideas that you think we should be doing at a federal level?
So this is where I'll get myself in trouble with your Midwestern, Heartland elite listeners. I think that our agricultural system is deeply broken, that we have subsidized scale to an unsustainable degree, and that has naturally conduced towards monocrop focus. The only way to really make money in industrial agriculture now is to either, you know, if you're doing livestock, it's to abuse your animals, and if you're doing just crops, then it's to just focus on corn and soy and maybe alfalfa to give the, you know, give the soil a rest. But even then, you're largely reliant on chemical fertilizers because the topsoil has been totally degraded by cycle after cycle of just corn and soy. I think something that's forgotten in these conversations when I bring up that perhaps we're a little over-reliant on corn and corn subsidies, whether it's through the RFS fuel standards, just look around. Like, we clearly, you know, there's corn in everything, every packaged or processed food. So clearly there's something going on here. We forget how actually recent the subsidy program and the way we do agriculture and the kind of shifting towards scale above everything is. Butts, forgetting his first name right now, was, I think it's during the Nixon administration, which is also not so coincidentally, possibly, when the EPA was established, shifted from what had been the New Deal method of subsidizing agriculture in America, which allowed for more particularity, more localization of crops, more flexibility, in my interpretation, had shifted to a new method of financial support for farming. And that new method really did advocate for just plant from fence to fence and follow the money, basically. And that's what's resulted. But that's, you know, if we think about that, that's only 2-3 generations of farming that's been done this way. But when you question it and say, perhaps we shouldn't have all of these fields be full of soy and corn, people say, are you attacking farmers? What are you doing? You know, I've made many an Iowan and Nebraskan upset because they have these fond memories of detasseling in high school, even if their families, you know, aren't directly farmers, if they're a white collar family, like the farming culture is still a part of their life, but they forget. I mean, it's easy to gloss over because we have this romantic view of American agriculture, the degree to which it's always just been this incredibly difficult industry that requires huge cooperation with state and federal governments, but also increasingly it's monopolistic, and these family farms are really kind of they're just employees. You know, it's like almost a neo-feudalism. They don't really, I mean, they're in such debt, they don't really own, like, they've triple mortgaged the farm, that they're basically serfs for, you know, Bayer Monsanto or Tyson, you know, Tyson Meats or what have you. So to my mind, you know, to kind of give the game away, like, Bison nationalism is in part putting a happy face on what would be a series of very hard policy questions about, like, is this actually good for us? How do we return some of this land to Natural Prairie or to local, actually, you know, particular ecologically consistent, right, local crops, restore variety. When I brought this up with policy people in DC before, it's funny, there's a kind of amnesia where if you want to tweak something or go back in one area, they assume you want to go back to everything, right? They're like, oh, are you advocating for getting rid of tractors? Like, is this a Wendell Berry situation? It's like, no, I I think we now have certain tools. We also now know some of the consequences of the choices we made, and we can go back and kind of repair some of the wrong choices, keep the tools that work, keep the tools that do in fact extend human capacities in positive ways that you know, allow us to be more fully human rather than kind of obscuring our humanity, and find ways to maintain these efficiencies but reflect better what local environments demand for their own health. Because as it is, we're trying to outrun the degradation of our environment via just agrochemicals, and that doesn't seem sustainable either. And I think if you look around your average American mall or airport, what have you, you kind of see the physical consequences on American people of some of these choices that we've made as we're just a increasingly diabetic and overweight, and we're not a healthy people. And part of, while there may be some sacrifices in scale, I don't think we have to, I'm not advocating degrowth. I think that we can maintain levels of efficiency while also being respectful of the what fits in a particular environment. And we're a transcontinental country. So if Washington is even further focused on apples and onions and what have you, you know, which are locally appropriate, Walla Walla onions, it's an apple state, Oregon the same, that doesn't mean we're not going to have, you know, corn or potatoes or whatever. We'll get those from Idaho. We'll get the potatoes from Idaho. Like, we're still gonna have trade, right? People, for some reason, if I advocate for localization and say local produce matters and we should make that accessible to more people by incentivizing or like restructuring our subsidy program such that that is the incentives pushed that way rather than towards monocrops. For some reason, people are like, well, it's not very efficient for us to have everyone growing everything in every state. And it's like, well, at no point did I say that. Like, we're still going to have internal trade. But, you know, the quantity and efficiency mindset is really hard for people to shake.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, to be fair, like in the broad scope of human history, the challenge has always been food insecurity, not having enough. And I mean, I think we have to say that modern agricultural and markets, I mean, they have achieved a lot in their ability to, you know, deliver, like, I mean, quite a surplus of calories for a very low proportion of a person's like budget, right? And that's not nothing. I mean, but we really are one of the first generations that struggles with, you know, obesity. I mean, that's a very recent problem. And the fact that we have so much easily available calorically dense foods, and so I think it's sort of a new kind of struggle, that's sort of brought on by the just farming technology. I mean, and some of that too. I mean, the strength of American agriculture is, in addition to serving the American people well in some respects, it's also a little bit of a foreign policy tool at times. It really, you know, many of our geopolitical rivals do not have the ability to feed themselves, and our ability to do so, I think, makes us much stronger from a national security perspective. I mean, especially when you've got countries that are dependent on our food supply.
But as we double down on, say, you know, corn to the exclusion of other products, we actually create a vulnerability too. And we've seen this with trade policy mm-hmm. around China, that, you know, as we subsidize soy for export, and China being our largest soy consumer from our exported soy products, then it becomes itself vulnerable to, you know, being part of trade wars, right? So when in response to one thing over here, now because we've doubled down on, oh well, like our whole market is just pig feed, you know, we send soy to China so that they and their brutal factory farms can fatten up their pigs. Well, that's a vulnerability too, right? Whereas if we'd focused more perhaps on our domestic market, and then we wouldn't have those vulnerabilities. We're also in a historically unprecedented period, not just in the Green Revolution in general, but in particular, like we've never had, I think, so few members of the population be farmers, right? And we're actually running into the problem of, well, at first that was cool because it seemed to indicate we didn't have to have farmers or didn't have to have as many, and people could get away from what is a very hard life. But at the same time, now we're in the place of, well, who's going to farm after this generation, right? Because people don't grow up in a culture of agriculture. They're not exposed to it regularly. So I think smaller farms, maybe less efficient in the abstract, but growing things that are actually used in your locality, more smaller farms may in fact be a more sustainable, both for domestic use, but also just culturally, that it maintains a continuous tradition of the craft, the folkways of farming. The other thing I think that is under discussed, and I would like to do more reading and research on, is just the simple observation that basic agriculture is not the only source of food. You know, livestock, animal husbandry, is this whole other part. And we, you know, much of the American population are the descendants of pastoralists. But we don't have, outside of some parts of Appalachia, we don't really have much of a pastoralist tradition, way of life being maintained. And yet that is kind of the folk way that is most natural, perhaps, to a large part of especially America's European descended population. And so, you know, what perhaps that should be more of an option, right? Or at least a more normal thing and that's part, in my mind, of bison nationalism is, I want to be a bison cowboy, and I'm unapologetic about that. I think it'd be cool. At this point, you know, you can be certain Native American tribes and be a bison cowboy. There's a few projects, bison ranches out there, but I think that should be like a normal part of American life. And also, you know, we all have this, one of the key American archetypes is the cowboy, and even as the West has closed, the frontier is closed, if we can reopen pockets of it and restore the possibility of a kind of pastoral existence. And I mean, my grandfather was a failed sheep farmer or sheep rancher. So, you know, there's a kind of a family history of this. Perhaps we just all get the itch at some point in our life, if you're in my matrilineal line, to just, start ranching. Because he was an aerospace engineer in the, you know, LA, Cold War rocket world, and then had a midlife crisis and decided it was time to move to Southern Oregon, be a sheep rancher, get off the grid, live closer to the land. So, you know, maybe I'm just expressing the kind of, anxieties or particular fixations, blood memories of my family. Well, but I do think that a kind of pastoralist urge, is something that doesn't get scratched anymore, but we all have these folk memories of it.
I think there's a lot to that. I mean, I think that, you know, one thing that we need to recover as a country is sort of regional distinctiveness. You know, we need to remember that a lot of these distinctive regions still have an organic connection to their old folkways. So that's out there. And then just getting an understanding for the terroir of our own country, right? Like the French have the terroir of their various regions. And our terroir has generally been obliterated by, you know, these large national at-scale operations. Like just take, you know, in Europe, you know, the jamón ibérico is famous, right? The Spanish ham. Like apparently, I just had a Portuguese friend, you know, tell me it's actually Portuguese in the Spanish stuff. But
very typical.
But you know, like what would it look like to have different regions of the country produce goods in a very like individuated way, where you know you could know, like I'm tasting something from Appalachia or from the West Coast, all of that difference has been obliterated. And of course, that's nice from an Epicurean standpoint to have these different flavors, but it's also like there's something sort of evocative and nationalist about it. It makes you feel proud to be from a particular place because your particular place has a particular excellence about it that nowhere else has. And everybody should, you know, feel like the place that they're from is the best, or at least, you know, there's some respects in which it's the best. And so it's kind of ennobling to try to find a way to give that back to people. But then, you know, I think the other thing that came to mind as you were talking there is that, technology has a role, like there's an optimistic role for technology in some of this actually. And like, so, you know, I study the beef industry a fair bit. You know, obviously it's the story there has been radical consolidation. You know, you could calve wherever you want, you know, but then when you sell your calves, you know, they go and they get, you know, they go to grower lots and then they go to feeder lots and then they go to, you know, one of the big three meat packers essentially. And so it's a very consolidated industry, and those three meat packers supply, I don't know what it is, it's probably over 90% of the beef that's sold in a grocery store in America. And, you know, automation and in some places regulatory innovation, especially around like USDA certifications for processing plants. But if you do some of that, you can really open up the possibility of like regional beef processing. And, you know, I think that's a key, and that probably requires some, you know, maybe some statutes or at least regs on the USDA side. The other optimistic thing is, I mean, automation in farming actually across the board is pretty exciting. Like robotics on farms are going to make organic farming a lot more cost effective because they reduce human labor. You know, vertical farming is also really interesting. I don't know if you have thoughts on vertical farming, but, you know, they've made a lot of advances in that, and that can, you can leave more of your country wilded if you get into vertical farming, which is attractive right to me, at least.
To the beef point, Thomas Massey has been working on that for a long time, and his I urge listeners to look up his Prime Act, PRIME capitals, and read up a little bit about that. I think it's worthy of support. He's trying to allow for more local beef processing, take off some of the regulatory burden there. But to your first point, Josh, I think you're highlighting this tension in American, both the regulatory system as a whole, but in particular the environmental regulatory system, which is, yes, we have this expansive continental nation. We are a collection of states and localities. We contain a multitude of ecosystems, specific ecologies. Of course, they're all connected, but at the same time, they're particular. And so this federalism, we have this opportunity for distinctives, but that is at odds with the needs of large corporations and even just the regulatory idea, right? That the idea that a national agency, a federal agency, can set nationwide standards at all necessarily flattens distinction and particularity, because you need regulations to be predictable, you need regulations to be consistent, and it's a burden on large companies. And we're a country that has been prone to scale and prone to, you know, we celebrate the production of large companies. It's a burden on large companies to have to adjust their practices for each particular, you know, each locality, and so our compromise has not really been much of a compromise. That over, you know, every time that this kind of tension happens, the centralization, standardization, flattening of distinctions has been the choice we've gone with. We've made it easier to regulate and easier to comply, and in doing so, have flattened out these distinctions and made it harder for these particularities. You know, you can't get the Appalachian version of Jamón Ibérico. You can't get because you're being subject, your pork product is being subject to the same regulation as a pork product in New Mexico. And those are just completely different ecologies, and they're going to be completely different growth patterns, seasonalities, all of the above, and you know, folk ways and traditions of how you use the animal. But because we have this need to provide national regulation, you're going to necessarily, in nationalizing standards, you have to flatten differences.
Yeah, one of the most like simple and evocative illustrations of that point I've ever heard is that before the advent of refrigeration and sort of the national produce market, there were hundreds of apple varieties. Like every region of the country had like, you know, 20 or 30 of their own varieties that were, you know, particular, sort of optimized for that locale. And then, you know, today, I mean, there's actually a huge concern about all of these heritage apple breeds going extinct because nobody grows them for personal use, and the big growers don't use them because the big growers just grow apples in Washington, I guess, in the Pacific Northwest, or, you know, a couple of handful of other places. And so I think that's spot on about, you know, what the function of regulation. And of course, I mean, this is every domain, right? But intensive regulation almost always, even if it's not intentionally trying to force larger scale, it almost always has the effect of forcing larger scale, because a larger firm can, you know, carry the, you know, they can spread out the cost of regulation and compliance in a way that's like economically prohibitive for the smaller player. So, you know, this is not unique to me. A lot of people make this critique, but, you know, generally speaking, anytime you heavily regulate a field, the largest players in that field are in support of it because it kills competition and disruption, kills the smaller players.
Right. The barriers of entry become all the higher. We shouldn't blame entirely, or I don't want listeners to think we're entirely blaming regulation, because the emergence of national markets themselves does the same thing to some degree. That, like, as you realize that you're going to try to sell the same product, or you have the opportunity because of transportation, what have you, the opportunity to sell the same product to someone, you know, say in upstate New York and also in Southern California, there's not naturally going to be standardization and movement towards scale there as well. And it just becomes all the harder for the small guys, the local guys, to compete. And so we have to think creatively about, you know, how do we restructure incentives? And I mean, I think one of the big things is to say, even as we set certain national environmental regulatory standards, don't let the federal administration dictate too much how to comply, right? That you should comply is, you know, a given, but the way you go about getting into compliance, and this is true, like they do this already. There are, you know, compliance is a process. They develop plans. There is supposed to be localized. We have, the EPA has 10 regional offices. But it's something you always have to bear in mind and say, like, to recognize that the tendency is going to be towards centralization and standardization, and to check that impulse and to say, okay, well, how do we deliberately go out of our way to foster the local and the particular, and to work with the particular needs of this ecology, and to recognize that it is distinct, and that it's, you know, this area will need something different, and maybe need more time or different measurements, what have you, in order to come into compliance with the national standards. So that's at least one way to think about it within the environmental standpoint.
Yeah. I mean, I think one other question that critics of your position will often raise is just that, you know, revealed preference of consumers runs against what you're saying, you know. So, the consumers like going to the grocery store, and they like being able to buy an orange any time of year, regardless of whether it's in season, right? Or an avocado or whatever, berries. I bought berries the other day and I realized, huh, you know, it's not, I guess, like, this is not berry season. You know, we're so accustomed to this sort of behavior. I guess I'm curious, what is the, you know, like, one, are there health considerations that come into play when you're restricting your diet to some extent to be more reflective of like the local cadence? And then number two, I mean, even if there were no health issues, but, you know, if consumers didn't like that, how do you deal with the fact that you've got consumers across the country who are used to being able to eat basically the produce of the world whenever they want to?
I mean, I think one is to sort of rehash the point that I made already, which is trade doesn't go away in this scenario. We just don't put all of our eggs, so to speak, in the corn and soy basket. I would, in my ideal America, I'm describing a much more diverse domestic market, right? We're trading internally and you're going to get products from all over the country still. But there'll be, you know, perhaps less restrictions on that being financially viable. On the flip side, you know, if you have a kind of philosophic objection to eating out of season and global food trade, sure, you could object to that. But there's nothing that I've described that would say you can't get your bananas year round necessarily. But those are like larger international trade questions and tariff policies and things like that, which are, you know, very likely to be critical to either administration. This next admin is going to almost certainly continue to explore more restrictionist, protectionist trade policies. So I suppose it's probably good for listeners to think about where their personal supply chain vulnerabilities are. Like, what is something that you just can't seem to live without that is most likely to be disrupted by whether it's increased antagonism with China or any other kind of deglobalization. We have entered this, and I guess on the pessimistic side, and, you know, prepare for the worst. This is the other motivation in my mind for a lot of what I've described, which is that we should perhaps get more used to eating things grown in North America, in part because we seem to be entering a period in international politics that could best be described as deglobalizing. Maybe the reemergence of strong, like hard multipolarity. America is very likely, you know, every indication would say we're going to remain the most powerful state in the world, but we will have to share space with more kind of civilizational or power poles around the world. And that's going to look different than the 90s. The 90s were an aberration, probably peak America, frankly. So some of this is just a kind of steering into the curve, steering into the turn on the ice, as we come to grips with an uncertain future that I'm sure is going to provide. I mean, like, COVID may have been, as much as it was an enormous tragedy, disaster, act of war, what have you, I mean, kind of domestic war too, it's in some sense a practice. It was a practice run in some ways. We got a picture of just how vulnerable our supply chains were, just how vulnerable domestic manufacturing is. And if people are paying attention, then they should think about the ways in which their personal lifestyle is dependent on something that may or may not be sustainable. And when we'll see which parts of those consumer choices are reproducible domestically and which parts were entirely dependent on a blip, a historical aberration in kind of just-in-time shipping and kind of modern globalization and logistics.
Yeah. And the policies are your vision for what agriculture looks like in the future. I mean, just to put it on the table very expressly, like, it's a very de-risked model. Even if it's like, you could even say it's less efficient, but it's also much less risky and sort of a tail risk scenario. You know, we're extremely vulnerable. What happens to American agriculture and food if we lose our fertilizer supply? I mean, like, right, you know, we're done. Or if we lose, you know, if there's some disruption in shipping or what have you, we'd be
or a new blight. You know, yeah, we could be two new blights away from just having no crops to sell the world. You know, I mean, just if when right, you focus on, and then there's a reason, you know, we have zombie corn specifically to oppose this, right? It's been GMO'd out the wazoo in order to prevent such a terrible eventuality. But it's still, the vulnerability exists there, the tail risk of some sort of disruption to what is a highly kind of complex and extended apparatus. And so, yes, I'm describing a kind of anti-fragility and the desire to lean into that.
So exit question, you know, we've beaten this topic up well. I could talk to you all day, but I'll ask you one exit question. If you could bring back one extinct species, what would it be and why would it be the chestnut tree?
So yes, the American chestnut is an exciting possible restoration of a nearly extinct or mostly extinct American distinctive, American archetype. It's last I saw, there's some drama. The GMO'd variety, there may have been some misfiling of permitting. So I haven't quite followed whether it's a regulatory issue or a science issue, what the combination is. The other problem in the kind of chestnut restoration thing is trees grow slowly. So we're not going to learn if that restoration is working for quite some time. As far as other extinct, I mean, so obviously I want there to be many more bison as far as megafauna goes, or megafauna go, but I think, and this is in some sense betraying my Upper West roots, those ranchers and my admiration for pastoralism, those ranchers won't like my answer, but like I do think the massive prehistoric wolves are just cool, and it'd be fun.
Didn't they call them wolves? I mean, they were huge. They're like as big as a bear we used to have. Yeah. I mean, they were massive.
But the other thing is, like, America still has, you know, enormous megafauna. People don't realize just how big a moose is. Those things are as large as cars. There are parts of the country, you know, parts of the continent that still have, where bears still get really, really big. If you have a good zoo or natural history museum in your area, you've probably seen a full-size taxidermied polar bear. Those things are huge. But all that to say, we should, I mean, as far as natural beauty and wonder and also the grandeur of our wildlife, I mean, I'll put up North America against any other part of the world. So,
yeah, 100%. All right. Well, Micah, thank you so much for joining us today. Tymon's having audio issues, so that's why he's been quiet. And I think just the energy of the rewilding has intimidated him a little bit in silence. But
I've left him, you know, uncharacteristically speechless.
You'll have to come back again soon. All right.
Sounds good.
Well, thank you so much. And audience, appreciate your time as always. And until next time, God bless.
You can find American Reformer on the internet at www.AmericanReformer.org or on X.com, formerly Twitter, at AM Reformer. Don't forget to like, rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast. Please consider supporting us today by making a tax-deductible donation through our secure online donation portal at AmericanReformer.org. That's AmericanReformer.org.